committee?
Yeah, we have three.
Okay.
You've got three.
Let's just run it.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare. It is May 11th, and are you okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2644.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2644, brought to you by Representative Malmstrom, received public hearing on April 11th. The bill provides the most effective procedure to be used in administration of vitamin K to newborn infants. Minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, passed out of the House with 56 yes votes, one no vote. Committee has the paperwork to move the bill, if it so desires.
Okay, discussion. Senator.
Well, let's have a motion first.
Yes, yeah, I have a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2644A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2644A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Steiner Hayward.
I just want to make it crystal clear, based on extensive experience and, more importantly, state law, that parents will always still have to consent, actively consent, before any medication is given to their child. So this bill does not take away that right at all. I just want to be crystal clear about that.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I want to confirm what Senator Steiner Hayward said. I asked the hospitals, or I asked for a report from hospitals as to procedure. The procedure isn't always the same, but they are informed of their rights, and it is always their choice. So
yep.
If a parent decides they do not want it, that is perfectly within their rights, and they are informed of that before anything happens.
Yep.
Thank you. All right. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer.
Excused.
Senator Canoe.
Excused.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chairman Sanders.
Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Steiner Hayward, would you carry the bill? Okay. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2644A and open, do we do this?
Yeah, 2303.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2303. We have a number of people, and so.
This is our first panel.
Okay.
David Simnett.
Okay, David Simnett, Royce Bolin, and Sarah Lochner.
And for folks out there, there is a dash A3. I know there's been a number of questions. It is on OLIS, so it is available to read.
Madam Chair, just to make it clear, I don't think I'm going to testify formally, but I will want to make a few comments from the dais about this bill. Thank you.
Okay, did you introduce the bill?
I did not. Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2882A, brought to you by the Oregon Health Authority. The measure does a couple of things. The bill changes the reporting date for CCOs to report primary care spending information to the Oregon Health Authority from December 31st to October 1st each year. The measure deletes statutory references to a community-based health care initiative and also specifies that in addition to the OHA director, a designee of the director can be appointed as a member of the Advisory Committee on Physician Credentialing Information. And the bill updates statutory language and deletes references to the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. There's a dash three. I'll let the folks describe the dash three. Leaving the House, the bill has minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and testimony is available on OLIS.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. My name is David Simnett, and I'm the Health Policy Director in the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here to testify today in support of House Bill 2303A. This is the Health Policy and Analytics Division housekeeping bill. As written, it does the following. It changes the due dates for CCOs to submit primary care spend data as required by Senate Bill 231 from December 31st to October 1st each year. And that change will allow the Oregon Health Authority the time necessary to produce and validate the annual primary care spending report.
Okay.
It removes statutory references to the Office of Health Policy and Research and replaces them with the Health Policy and Analytics Division in the Oregon Health Authority, the place where these responsibilities now reside. It repeals ORS 743B206. This is an outdated statute that predates the Oregon Health Policy Board. It repeals ORS 735-721 through 735-727. These statutes relate to community-based healthcare initiative that was funded by a temporary safety net grant that has ended. It allows the OHA director's designee to the director or the designee to appoint members to the advisory committee on physician credentialing information. And it amends ORS 441-233 to clarify that OHA shall make rules pertaining to the physician credentialing program, not specifically the director of OHA. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2303 today, and happy to answer any questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Royce Bolin. I'm the Behavioral Health Policy Director for Oregon Health Authority. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2303, Amendment 3. This amendment would create a state registry within the Health Licensing Office of the Oregon Health Authority for unlicensed behavioral health practitioners, including qualified mental health professionals, qualified mental health associates, hypnotherapists, life coaches, parenting coaches, sexologists, and somatic therapists. I'm going to review just the some of the highlights of the amendment. The amendment begins with Section 13, technical language to add these provisions to statutes. Section 14 requires two sets of behavioral health practitioner registry within the Health Licensing Office. Behavioral health practitioners and alternative behavioral health practitioners. For the behavioral health practitioners, there are qualified mental health professionals and qualified mental health associates. And then the alternative behavioral health practitioners are the hypnotherapist, the sexologists, the somatic therapists, life coach, parenting coach, and wellness coach. Sections 15 through 17 changes all statutory references to QMHPs to the definition provided in this bill. Sections 18 through 29 give the Health Licensing Office the authority to administer this program. Final sections, the operative dates. Registration requirement takes effect the January 1st of 2018, giving people 30 days to register. The rest of the bill takes effect upon passage, so the HLO and OHA can begin work to set up the program and rulemaking. Community mental health programs and their contract providers employ staff that are qualified mental health professionals, otherwise known as QMHPs, and qualified mental health associates, otherwise known as QMHAs, to provide the community mental health services. QMHPs are master-level clinicians that may or may not be licensed. They conduct assessments, develop treatment plans, and deliver services. Their treatment plans are approved and signed off by a licensed medical practitioner. A QMHA is a bachelor's level staff that delivers skills building services under the direction of a QMHP. A QMHP or a QMHA may not practice independently. They can only provide services as part of their employment. Currently, QMHPs and QMHAs are defined in licensing and certification Oregon administrative rules. OHA holds the providers accountable for assuring that the staff meet the credentialing requirements for both a QMHA and a QMHP. The programs are responsible for providing proper supervision and holding the staff accountable to those credentialing standards. There is no statewide centralized oversight of these staff. If there's a complaint, the program is responsible for addressing the complaint. This amendment would establish a statewide registry for QMHAs and QMHPs. A centralized agency would review and approve individuals for one of these titles. The agency would establish a code of ethics that govern their practice. The central agency would receive and investigate complaints. The registry would provide a layer of consumer protection that is currently not available. This amendment was crafted to address consumer protection without jeopardizing the strained behavioral health workforce. Amendment 3 does not expand or limit the current practice of QMHAs or QMHPs, but it provides greater consumer protection. Some licensed behavioral health professionals have expressed concern with this proposal that QMHPs are permitted to assess and diagnose mental health disorders. As a reminder, this amendment does not expand the practice of a QMHP. As written, it still requires a QMHP to practice only within the auspices of behavioral health program, which requires the oversight of a licensed professional. This is consistent with current practice. Others have expressed concern that QMHAs and QMHPs will need to have criminal background checks and may inadvertently prevent individuals from performing these services.
You said it does or does not?
It does not.
Does not?
No. It doesn't add any additional burden. Currently, all QMHPs and QMHAs undergo a criminal background check as part of their employment with an agency. Therefore, this bill should not necessarily limit staff from being registered. We will ensure this happens during the rulemaking process. We've also heard concerns that this bill will hinder the recruitment of behavioral health professionals in rural and frontier communities. We have and will continue to work very closely with stakeholders to assure this does not happen. In addition, we heard that the peer support specialist community, that this would create a duplicate process for them, since to bill Medicaid, peers must register with the traditional health care worker commission. As such, we have exempted them from the registry and said this amendment specifies they must register with the traditional health care worker commission. This way, all the peers will be registered in one place with one code of ethics and one oversight entity. The amendment also seeks to register alternative practitioners such as hypnotherapists, life coaches, and parenting coaches. Doing so will help OHA wrap its arms around the universe that exists and establish a complaint process, sanctions, and protect the public from irresponsible or ill-informed practitioners. I believe Senator Steiner Hayward is going to talk a little bit more about this at a later time. This amendment aligns well with the Behavioral Health Collaborative's work that is focused on establishing core competence for behavioral health staff. Those competencies should emphasize trauma-informed care, person-centered planning, culturally and linguistically appropriate services. They should focus on prevention and health promotion, the social determinants of health, and other research-based, outcome-driven interventions. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions for the panel? Do you want to say your...
Yeah, I'll just speak very briefly. I think Mr. Bullen did an excellent job. Mr. Cement did an excellent job outlining the need for this bill. But I want to be clear that there's some backstory here that's also important. While the vast majority of QMHPs and QMHAs do exactly what they're supposed to do, we do have some situations that are documented where they have been practicing beyond their scope, and it can be hard to figure out how to manage that, especially if we don't know exactly where they all are. The reason this is a registry rather than licensure is because there are already ways that they deal with being certified as a QMHP or a QMHA. We simply want to know where everybody is. The other problem, the part that relates to all of the other folks who were listed, the coaches, the hypnotherapists, everything, is that all of these folks can have a significant impact on people's mental health. And many of them many of them are more than legitimate, have exactly the right training, know when they're getting in over their heads. But on the other hand, we do have a case in Oregon where a psychologist was directly involved in the death of a child as a quote-unquote parenting, helping the parents parent this child in ways that were entirely inappropriate, lost her license, and now markets herself as a parenting coach. So I think we just need to have a sense of where folks are, what they're doing, have a standard code of ethics so that we can make sure that Oregonians, when they seek out services from a coach or somebody who else to improve their mental health and their ability to function in this world, are at least getting somebody who's taken the time to register with the state, and we have an ability to track them down later. With regard to the concern about the certified alcohol and drug counselors, I know that other people will be testifying about this further. I've been working closely with them, and Mr. Bolin mentioned that we've proposed that they actually register just with the traditional healthcare workers, even if they are QMHP or QMHA, because we don't want we want to make sure that their primary role is the one that where they're providing such important service as an alcohol or drug counselor. And many of them do have more complicated backgrounds based on their behaviors when they were not sober. And now that they've been sober for a while, we don't want them to suffer the inability to get a job because they're doing all the right things. So we want to be sure to protect people who've turned their difficult life experiences into ones that will benefit others who are trying to take a better path. So it's really important that we do that. I think that other additional amendment is going to take a little tweaking. So it's obviously not ready today, and it's not up in OLAS. So when we get to the place where we're ready to move this bill forward. But the rest of this is just simply trying to get a handle on what's out there. Nothing more than registration, just so we know where people are. Thank you, Madam Chair.
The only questions I had were the implementation date. I know this has an emergency clause and rulemaking would start, and then there's a 30-day window. And if the 30-day window, if it goes into effect January 1 and 30 days is holiday season in December, that seems like a pretty short timeline. So that's number one. How are you going to notify everyone? That's the second thing. And why isn't this going to, or will this be going to Ways and Means because of the amendment?
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, Sarah Lochner, Oregon Health Authority. We agree that the 30 days is pretty quick. We would be willing to make that window larger. I don't believe this bill will go to Ways and Means. The way Health Licensing Office works is they attach a fee to the registration in order to make the bill no fiscal, and that's the way they operate their current programs. I've been told by them that they guesstimate, based on other programs, that the fee would be $50, which you can decide if you feel that's reasonable or not. It would be a one-time registration. So.
Usually those are done by Ways and Means, but we have the Human Services Chair here, so.
That's true. We can talk about it further, but I think the Health Licensing Board does have the authority to set those fees in rule. The only point that I would make, if I could, Madam Chair, they would only have to register once, but they would be required to update their location and things like that should that change. We're not trying to turn this into a money-making enterprise for the state or anything like that. We're just trying to wrap our heads around who's out there doing what to try to help Oregonians have better lives.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Just a comment to the work that's still to be done to Senator Steiner Hayward on alcohol and drug counselors. Some of the best people in that field have gotten there by very interesting pathways.
That's exactly my point,
so,
Senator.
Yes.
I completely agree, and we're trying
I
to
totally
make sure
agree.
That they're not
yeah.
limited in their ability to continue
yes.
to provide
yes.
these services. So we're working very closely with ACBO to make sure that yeah. we get to the place where everybody feels confident that we're getting everybody registered but not preventing anybody from practicing in the ways that they're trained and certified to do, because I completely agree with you.
Further questions? All right. Thank you very much. Let's call Mike Marshall, Michael Nigel, and Cheryl Ramirez.
Good morning. Mike Marshall. For the Addiction Counselor Certification Board of Oregon, ACBO, Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, thank you for that clarification, Senator Steiner Hayward. And I do want to make a further clarification, which is peer counselors and certified alcohol and drug counselors, there's CADC 1, 2, and 3, are all different distinctions. And as you know, ACBO for 40 years now has been certifying CADCs, certified alcohol and drug counselors. Not surprisingly, even though we are last in the nation in terms of access to drug and alcohol treatment, we are far above the national average in terms of treatment completion rates. And we're confident that that's because ACBO has just been doing such a great job over the last 40 years. We fully support a registry. But wanted to draw your attention to some potential unintended consequences of 2303 as the way it's currently structured. I will freely admit I have not had a chance to look at the most updated version of the amendment that was dropped a half hour ago. The primary concern here is that many CADCs also in their current roles are QMHAs, and some of them actually serve as QMHPs. As Senator Cruz pointed out, there's many paths to becoming a CADC, and currently a CADC's employer does a way test in terms of a background check, a criminal background check, and they're able to look at all the different components here of someone's background, their education, their training that's brought them to this place. And we're concerned under the current legislation that there would be a uniform background check that wouldn't take into those considerations. And what you would have then is a CADC who, in their employment, are also a QMHA or a QMHP, and they would lose the ability to serve in that role, which would probably make them unemployable. Most treatment providers don't have extra resources. And then the other concern is that, obviously, CADCs have a minimum of a two-year college education in order to be a CADC, and then at different levels at 4 years and a master's degree, that they have spent a lot of time and invested a lot of resources into their education, and should there be different educational criteria that their current employer accepts and qualifies them as a QMHA or QMHP, but that the new registry would disqualify them, that they would have to interrupt their employment and go back to school in order to meet that. And so what we would like to propose in the amendment that Senator Steiner Hayward recommended was that of CADC in good standing, that their criminal background check, as long as it's been 5 years since their last conviction, that be accepted in lieu of any new background check criteria that is established. And also that the bill take into consideration the existing education level and training and experience and reviews that they've received as CADCs, so that that can be considered, if need be, in lieu of the education requirements that might be required by the registry. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. I am Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. I'm here on behalf of those community mental health programs that employ, supervise many of the QMHPs and QMHAs we're talking about here. I just want to thank Senator Steiner Hayward and OHA for working with us on the amendment to this bill. Registry is really important to us, and it's a pathway for licensure for those who are qualified to be licensed. I also think that we're working with ACBO on a parallel certification process that will work well with this registry. So I'm here in support of House Bill 2303 as amended, and we agree with establishing the registry for qualified mental health professionals, QMHPs, and qualified mental health associates, QMHAs, under the title of behavioral health practitioners. And we also agree to put the other six professional categories under the title of alternative behavioral health practitioners. So as you may know, there are two, or at least two, separate initiatives underway to help resolve the behavioral health system workforce issues. One is legislative through this bill to create a registry. And as I mentioned, we're working on a parallel certification process with ACBO. The other is led by OHA. I believe you had an informational hearing on the Behavioral Health Collaborative's recommendations. There's a workforce recommendation that it's a recommendation to perform a needs assessment of the current workforce and a comprehensive plan, so that we have a well-trained behavioral health workforce, which is inclusive of certified and licensed clinicians, unlicensed clinicians, peer support specialists, community health workers, and others throughout the state. So we support working with our key system partners on initiating the registry and certification process with a comprehensive workforce plan before mandating licensure through legislation. The one concern we had, which is something Chair Mona Sanderson already brought up, was the short timeline for registration of 30 days. For people who are newly hired, they have to go through a background check, and that often takes more than 30 days. Also, at the onset of this registry, we'll probably have a glut of QMHPs and QMHAs registering, and I think maybe the health licensing office may have trouble keeping up at the beginning. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Chair Anderson and committee members, I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2303 as amended. My name is Michael Nagel, and I am an alternative therapist, and I've been in private practice in Portland for 14 years. And back in February of this year, I and a fellow a colleague, Stephen Shostak, spoke and testified against House Bill 2361, I believe it was, which would have removed an exemption that covered our ability to practice. At that time, rather than suggesting that their exemption be removed, we advocated that a registry do be developed and that the registry perhaps be modeled after what was called the Vermont Plan. We have considered, or I have considered, this amendment, and I believe that it satisfies all my concerns. In fact, that it works on behalf of protecting not only the public, but also our professions. I have only one concern, though, and that is to share that educational requirements for different practices that are covered by this bill may have varied by comparing the time that a person was certified or qualified to practice as, for example, a hypnotherapist, and however the regulations might be developed by the committee or by the advisory committee, they may differ. And so if there's a significant difference, I want to suggest that perhaps the advisory committee consider how the state of Washington handled this difference when they were implementing a new status of mental health professional. At that time, what they did was allowed the grandfathering of certain practitioners who perhaps did not meet the qualifications that they were now implementing. So I'd like to suggest the possibility of grandfathering, where appropriate, practitioners who perhaps their former education does not meet the current standards. Thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of the bill.
Senator Cruz?
And just a question, because you talked about 5 years from the last conviction. I'm just wondering if the timeline should be more in line with completion of sentence rather than time of conviction. Just a thought.
We would certainly be open to that conversation. It makes sense, Senator. I just would want to get a sense of what that timeline actually is practically for many of these folks.
No, I fully understand that. I'm just I have random thoughts from time to time.
Okay.
So I'm just trying to think that from completion of sentence would be demonstrating good time sort of thing. So just something to think about.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
I wouldn't have, okay.
Eric Singer, Mary Jo Herman, and Michelle DeLude. Please begin. Go ahead.
Hello. My name is Eric Singer. Thank you for letting us testify. I'm a hypnotherapist for 43 years. I help clients through holistic methods to reduce stress, to become better athletes, to be better students, to change behavior through imagery. And I know there was a exemption that didn't pass. They were going to eliminate an exemption that would have put a lot of us out of business. And then I found out late last night that there was another agency being created, which is very large, very broad. And as I read about it, I think we're all here to find ways to protect the public, and a registry is not a bad idea. But looking at this bill, it's massive. The way it was put out, was really covert, in my opinion, and it's substantial that we all found out about it. And half this room is full of people who are not in favor of it, who found out about it yesterday or last night. So my question is, and now it's an emergency bill, of course, which as soon as it takes effect, it takes effect. What I'm trying to understand is why not be open to this? Why not invite the groups in so we can participate in the discussion and not find out about it by coincidence and understand that our profession is looking to be put under this umbrella agency that just really, I mean, who are the board of directors? Who's the advisory committee? Are they in tune with us? Are there hypnotherapists represented in the committee? It's just too big, and I'm fearful of it, quite frankly. So thank you for letting me participate.
Let's have the whole panel and then comments.
Okay. My name is Mary Jo Herman, and I'm a certified hypnotist. I'm a part of the National Guild of Hypnosis. And my question is, why are we put under such a broad scope? We don't diagnose. We're not part of the medical field. What we do is help people change their lives just by facilitating. We work with conscious, subconscious mind. We're not there to instruct them how to do anything. We just use their suggestions. So we're putting being put under a huge, broad microscope here. And I just don't understand how hypnosis fits in this.
And then I'd like to make some comments.
Yeah. My name is Michelle DeLude. I am a consulting hypnotist in Portland, Oregon. I have been using hypnosis with clients since 2004. I have 9,000 and more client hours, and I have more than 600 hours of continuing education experience, which I am required to have every year as a standing member of the National Guild of Hypnotists, which has a list of ethical requirements for us that we do not step beyond our scope of practice. We do not prescribe or diagnose or treat. We are not medical professionals, and we have a list of ethics that requires us to refer. And my concern is that the Amendment 3 takes this bill from a housekeeping bill to something that establishes an oversight that may be very costly to both the state and practitioners. I was not able to read the amendment until just very recently, and I would like. I have no objection to registry. In my understanding, it's worked well in Colorado and in Washington and another state. However, I have real concerns about its placement in this particular bill at this particular time. And thank you for letting mm-hmm. me speak.
And I'm a retired public health nurse, and I strongly believe in all kinds of therapies and hypnosis, hypotherapy, art therapy. I mean, all of these help make are very effective on many, many of our patients. And I believe in a holistic type of healthcare system. And I think all of you are part of the healthcare system. And to try to use methods other than medication is, for me, extremely important. And I think we really need to know who you are. And if there are complaints, we don't have a mechanism to follow up at this point in time. So I'm sure this will grow. We're not going to move the bill. We're going to give you the opportunity to read the amendment, see how it affects it, and I know that the committee would love to have your input, and we would probably work the bill not next week, but the following week. So hopefully there'll be time for you to read the amendment and see how that would impact you, and then let us know. Other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard, is it Ulrich? Ulrich and Catherine Wilson and Josine Bennett. I'm not sure I'm reading that. Joseph Bennett?
Yes, Bennett. Thank you.
Okay, Bennett.
I just have very bad handwriting.
That's all right.
Good afternoon, and thank you for hearing us. My name is Joseph Bennett. I'm a current member and serve on the board of directors of the Oregon Hypnotherapy Association. I practiced hypnotherapy in Oregon for over 20 years before retiring in 2007. In those years of practice, the Oregon Board of Psychiatrist Examiners, the OBPE, has on several occasions sought to quietly pass legislation to essentially eliminate our profession. We've had to deal with them many times over this. In this, as in other attempts, we hypnotherapists, those stakeholders were not invited to participate in the process of creating the Dash 3 amendment that is before this committee today. We were not even notified of today's hearing. We discovered it quite by accident. To the point of the bill, I encourage the committee members to vote no on the amendment as it is currently written, which you mentioned we want to work on it some more. I hope you will. This bill would put hypnotherapists under the authority of an agency with little to no understanding of our profession, yet with broad powers to limit our activities, assess fees and sanctions, set educational requirements, and more without representation and without making a case for public safety. In addition to not protecting the public from unscrupulous practitioners, this bill would simply harm or destroy the businesses of ethical practitioners who currently provide safe, responsible, goal-oriented hypnotherapy for their clients. As has been stated already, hypnotherapists do not diagnose, treat, or prescribe. We educate, suggest, encourage our clients, and assist them to achieve their goals. Today, hypnotherapists all over the state of Oregon provide complimentary services for licensed practitioners. Hypnotherapists train corporate teams, businesses, and other groups how to de-stress through relaxation techniques, visualizations, and self-hypnosis, none of which requires registration or licensure to protect the public. Hypnotherapists rely upon word-of-mouth advertising, testimonials, and high ratings on social networks. None of us can afford an unhappy client. The market drives us to behave ethically, to ever improve our competencies, to immediately resolve client complaints, and to adhere to applicable laws and regulations. It is in our best interest. Irresponsible hypnotherapists soon fail. Criminal hypnotherapists can deal with the criminal justice system just like anyone else. Hypnotherapists in general are hardworking, often one- or two-person businesses who promote their local communities financially, material, and energetically. Hypnosis is a natural process that, combined with metaphoric imageries, stories, and suggestions, offers some people a complement to licensed care. This is essentially true for those, this is especially true for those who prefer a more holistic approach. It is my belief that this Dash 3 amendment is another attempt by the OBPE to secretly slip in legislation to identify alternative practitioners and thus save the OBPE the effort of locating them by other means. This is in the OPBE's continuing effort to use the power of the state to bother, threaten, harass, and intimidate hypnotherapists until they either move out of the state or stop practicing. By registering hypnotherapists, the OBPE will gain direct control over a governing mechanism regulating our businesses, not us. No more need for harassment. The board can simply dismiss any and maybe all hypnotherapists. I'm deeply concerned that this amendment was attached to this bill without warning and without proper stakeholder participation. Thank you for the opportunity to testify against this amendment.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Senator Anderson, Senator Hayward, and Oliver Drops, and Senator Cruz, and Senator Beyer. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I I deeply respect our ability to be able to speak today. My name is Kat Wilson, and I'm the owner of a Positiva Center in Portland, Oregon. I'm a trainer in coaching, hypnotherapy, and communication. And I focus on the skills that help people on a higher level of positive communication. As I just learned about this amendment yesterday, quite by accident, once again, probably going to hear that more than once, so I apologize. But one of the surprising things is that this has a real effect on not only my students and my colleagues, but myself and our well-being and how we support ourselves. Two of the individuals who were very involved in working with the important conversation here are currently out of the area, and they were mentioned before, Stephen Riz Betancourt and Stephen Shostek. And they were actually trying to encourage that there was something that was going to be similar to the Vermont rules on hypnotherapists. I have been part of some of this conversation, but you'll have to forgive me. I'm rambling a little bit because I just really haven't had time to prepare. I'm only putting my fingers in. I'm here to testify against passing this amendment, basically because we're really short-sighted on it. It's being done in a really fast way, and it's surprising and curious. This amendment is being slipped into the bill at the last minute without notice of the effects. My concern is on the process of making changes to Oregon HB 2303-3. It affects a multitude of professionals who deserve a say in this amendment. We need to be included. And I did hear Senator Anderson say she was a nurse, and I deeply appreciate that you have seen hypnotherapy useful. But coaching, you see, is also useful. This bill also will affect our education levels, and many of us already have spent thousands of dollars in our education towards what we're doing. We've invested in learning. We've invested in businesses that we rely on, and for many of us, this is our second career in our life and later on in our life as well. This action today follows the recent conversation, which you've heard once before, about HB 2361, which did not pass, and that was to delete a clause that supported alternative practitioners being able to do their businesses, and it would have taken away our ability to work and also to support ourselves and help others. Again, it did not pass, and for good reasons. Today's emergency session was not announced to the community of people in coaching and hypnotherapy organizations it would affect. As a member of the coaching community and Oregon Hypnotherapy Association, as well as a past president of the Portland National Guild of Hypnotists, I care deeply in supporting my community and work diligently to provide what I would say is a listening ear. And I ask for your ear now. The livelihood, economy, and the ability to literally hundreds in many career paths with interesting titles are providing options for alternative therapy. And these people only strive to make a positive difference in the lives of people. Safety is important, and I totally agree with this. But I don't know that doing what you're doing today is including, you know, a number of other, you know, aspects of this. We operate in a very ethical way. People who are members of the Oregon Hypnotherapy Association prescribe to very strong ethics. People in the International Coach Federation prescribe to very important ethics. The course I wrote in coaching is board certified by the Center for Credentialing and Education, which also has strong ethics as well. Coaching is a process for asking deep questions and helping people find their motivation. You see, it's not a medical process. And we have very ethical guidelines in all the organizations in which I've been a part of. I am an alternative therapist, and I'm a trainer in Portland, Oregon. I've helped a lot of people create a way for them to be able to support themselves by teaching them what I know, what's been published, and over a period of 20 years, helping thousands of Oregonians who seek alternative attention to assist them. Now, my clients include mostly everyday people, educated, life learners, including judges, engineers, teachers, doctors, artists, children, young adults, and normal everyday people from almost every culture and walk of life. My services include paid as well as pro bono work for those who cannot afford them. In my time in Oregon, I have won a world award in my work with children. I do not put myself out as a mental health counselor. I do hold degrees and a lot of different certifications. I do not diagnose. I don't prescribe medications. And I always make sure my clients have knowledge of my education. And this is the same thing that my students who graduate from my courses do as well. My training programs do include board-certified coaching. So, of course, I'm very curious and interested in this bill. My training also includes hypnotherapy, neurolinguistic programming, creativity, diversity training, listening, mindfulness, and many more programs to assist better understanding, communication, and alternative practices. People want training in alternative therapy for many reasons. Many experience more freedom in their minds, in their hearts, their souls. And then they sought training so that they too could make a difference in the lives of others and earn a living doing really good work. Not everybody learns from a university, you know. Some people learn in other ways, and they have very important type of life roles. All hypnosis is self-hypnosis. Our clients do the work. We're simply guides along the way to hear them. Sometimes we simply need to be listened to, as you all probably know. And this is where my clients seem to find their answers, is in being heard. I realize this isn't the first time this attempt has been made to squash the livelihood. Each time the bills failed for appropriate reasons, which are still true today, please give us a little more time on this. Let us work with you on this. Don't pass it today. We are here for many who appreciate our services. So I would be very happy to help in any way I could. And I just want to say thank you very much for supporting a world of caring alternative practitioners. And I know this is hard to listen to so many different words, and you're all doing so very well. Thank you for hearing.
Thank you. Madam Chair?
Yeah.
I realize we haven't heard from the third member of the panel, but I'd like to say something that's pretty important. I'm one of the people who's encouraging this legislation. I'm a family physician. I've worked with hypnotherapists as a patient and as a professional. I refer people to them. I'm disappointed to hear that you think that there's a conspiracy to have the psychologists take over your practices and kick you out of the state. I would be horrified if I learned that was the case, and I would fight for your ability to continue to practice. I agree. The vast majority of hypnotherapists and other alternative practitioners provide critically important services well within the scope of their practices, and they're crystal clear about their own limits. And the same is true for most physicians. And yet we all know, and I will say, that members of my profession have done things that I think are unconscionable. And I bet you can both guarantee, you're on the board, I bet you can guarantee that there are certain people that you're sad to say are members of your profession. And all we're trying to do here is to wrap our arms around where folks are. In some ways, you could make a pretty good argument that this might be a way for us to be able to let people know which parts of the state they could practice in. You know, where are there places where we don't have enough hypnotherapists? Where are there places where certain kinds of skills might be needed so that we can help people move into professions that do provide great livelihoods and do provide important services for people in our community? So I want to be crystal clear. I have enormous respect and admiration for people who do the kinds of work that you do. I've used their services. I've referred people to their services. This was not poorly thought out. I have been working on this since last summer. We had another vehicle. I've been having conversations with people. We are also required to post these hearings at least 48 hours in advance. So I know this was posted last Friday. I'm sorry that you guys didn't hear about it, but there are specific posting requirements that we have, and we've met them. So is it perfect how this is happening? No. Are we open to suggestions? Absolutely. But I want to get it on the record really clearly. There's no conspiracy theory here. There's no desire to put hypnotherapists out of business. This is not intended in any other way than to wrap our hands around who's out there doing what. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Senator Hayward, I appreciate that you're willing to stand up and fight for him. I've actually been here since 1990.
State your name.
I'm Richard Anrich. I've been here since 1990, and I've actually been to the House legislature on a couple of occasions. And when he mentioned a part about we actually have had some run-ins with the psychologist trying to put us out of business. So I appreciate you're going to stand up and fight for us. And I understand how difficult it is to sit here and just listen to us all go blah, 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 and all things. So one of my concerns was that, yes, I guess it did fulfill the 48 hours getting out there, but the way it was put out that we didn't even know that we were an attachment to a bill.
The amendment.
Amendment to the bills. We didn't even know that. And we barely found out about it yesterday, and we've been scrambling to get in here. So I hope the next time that there's going to be some more with this that it gets out and we can know what the amendment is and how we're all connected so we can get together and converse on that.
Well, the amendment was posted just an hour ago, or an hour and a half ago, I guess. And we know it's very last minute, and that's why we're not going to pass the bill. Yeah. It's going to
today. We're not going to pass the bill today.
Today.
Yeah.
Today. And so that will give you time to then respond to it. Oh, I forgot to mute it. Okay. So just to let you know, I have put as notes to make sure that you understood there is no way that we want to do away with hypnotherapy.
Appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you. And I also have a life coaching background, neuro-linguistic programming. I've been an instructor, trainer, and all of those pieces of it. And I appreciate you're looking for a holistic way. And we're trying to help people without drugs get there.
That's right.
And whether it fits or not, I told most of my people that my clients are just like us. We're normal neurotics. They just want their lives to be better. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're trying to do through hypnosis, through guided relaxations, through visualizations of all kinds, and just to kind of help them to be able to get that place where, yeah, lives are better. That's all we really want. So registration may make some sense. My concern would be, since we did have some run-in with psychologists, is they do, as Joe said, may have it as a way to, oh, now we know where everybody is. And they're trying to make it where every word that has therapy in it is no longer allowed. Every word, you know, we're not trying to be psychotherapists. We've never have used those. We tell our clients and our people we train that they need to know what their area of expertise is and not to get outside it. And if they're not there, then they need to refer to the psychologist or to the doctors or whoever is there. And so we try to do it with integrity. So that's what we want to do, is make sure that we understand what's there and have some voice.
Great. Comment? Thank you very much. And the final panel is Trina Butter, Dina, and then Robert
Plomondon.
Oh, okay.
I was just in toes, not testifying. Thank you.
You don't need to testify?
Yes.
Okay, is there anyone else that wants to testify? Oh, okay, so you come up. You're not on the list, but you can come up. Please proceed.
Okay. I'm Robert Plomondon. I'm a hypnotherapist in Corvallis, Oregon. I'm also a computer engineer with about 35 U.S. patents, free-range egg farmer, and publisher. I have a site called unlicensedpractitioner.com. I'm the guy who forced the psychology board to finally admit that the counseling exemption actually exists, because they were prosecuting people for unlicensed practice of psychology who were covered by the exemption. So if you're not part of the conspiracy, that's great, but there has been one. I want you to really understand that it's really true. So let's see. Oh, and for what it's worth, the group of people who see me most commonly for hypnotherapy are nurses. I don't know why that is. But they're lots of fun. I like nurses a lot. The OHA people, I'm sorry, I didn't get their name written down, so they wanted to wrap their arms around the alternative practitioners. Now, for me, if somebody hasn't wrapped their arm around a problem yet, they really don't deserve to be given any power yet. First, they need to wrap around their arms around it. Then they need to write the legislation and go through the whole thing. So I think it's premature. Remember, there's two groups of people here. There's the healthcare system, the formal healthcare system, which includes QMFAs and QMHAs and QMHPs, but doesn't include the rest of us who can't get, you know, insurance payments and, you know, not employed by hospitals, that sort of thing. The OHA has a lot of experience with everybody inside the system, and they have no experience with people outside the system. And they haven't found out. They haven't contacted us. They haven't been kicking the ball back and forth. I mean, a member of the Oregon Hypnotherapy Association, the National Guild of Hypnotists, and the Oregon Counseling Association. And I didn't hear about this till lunchtime yesterday either. So the word isn't out. I don't know who's been consulted about this, but it looks like Apparently, anybody from COPACT here today? And the COPACT group, which has been championing the counseling exemption for all these years, not because it's perfect, but because nothing that's really practical has been put up in its place. They opposed HB 2361, which died in committee, and here, something which will also make it so that we can't practice except under rules put by people who are part of the formal healthcare system with no apparent control by the alternative one. Here we are again. Had a couple other points. One is that the people keep talking about people can't complain to the board about me if I'm a bad hypnotherapist. Now, if I were a licensed professional, I would like there to be a board they can complain to, because without a license, working under an exemption, all they can do is sue me or call the cops. Okay? If they can complain to a board instead, that's better. I don't have to pay the victim damages. I don't go to jail. I mean, that's great. I think that what I'd like to see, I don't really want to see a registration with a board over us. I'd like to see a registration where you pay your $50, post the same bond as a roofing contractor, and you're in. Then if people sue me because I'm a bad hypnotherapist, then it's because I posted a bond, they know they can get some damages out of me. I mean, that's real protection. You know, it doesn't take 2 or 3 years, and you know, damages get given. I'm blue-collar enough to be satisfied to have the same kind of protection for the public as people have to post a bond. And so, finally, I just don't think that the OHA really has their arms around. I think they said they really don't have their arms around the alternative therapy. We're outside their system. We're outside their range of experience and expertise. It's a whole different ball of wax out there. Since we don't take insurance, our clients are self-paying. They're self-motivating. They want value for their dollar. It's very different from the people who are kind of trapped inside the system. I mean, a lot of you guys, is, I'm sure, your time is spent trying to protect the people who are trapped inside the system and get the kind of care they deserve. Well, as people in private practice who can't take insurance, that problem doesn't intersect with us. We're dealing with people who are on their feet and able to pay and able to say, this isn't working, see ya, and be gone instantly. And, you know, sue us if we don't refund their partial payment or whatever. You know, this is a different ball of wax. And so I want you guys to keep that in mind when you think about this amendment. I don't know what ought to be done with alternative practitioners, but it's not this. It's going to be a real burden to the OHA, and I think a whole bunch of crossed wires is going to happen to no great purpose.
Thank you.
My name is Sarah Graves, and thank you for letting me get in under the wire. I did not know about the amendment until late last night. I am the current Oregon Charter Chapter President of International Coach Federation. I'm glad that you're not looking at passing this bill today. We would like to offer what we do as a credentialing body, and also with our standards of ethics and requirements and ongoing education. Throughout the country, a lot of universities now, including University of Minnesota, Columbia, Harvard, all have coaching credentialed programs in their universities. It is very separate from psychology. It is not considered mental health professional. Coaching has to do with self-initiated change by the client that is coming to the coach to brainstorm ideas, to look at goals in their life and where they want to head. I do admit, and in fact in our study and research at global level, that people that are calling themselves coaches without the proper credentialing is in fact impacting our industry. So I would like to have some time, and we will submit some documentation for you to see what we are doing in the coaching industry. But I think that to, you know, sort of put it together, we do not consider ourselves mental health professionals, and the organization itself does not credential based on that. We have 130 countries with coaches, 30,000 credentialed coaches around the world, with a very high level of ethics and standards and ongoing requirements. Every 3 years we have to renew our credential with 40 hours of education and training. We are tested, there are background checks, there's a lot of things that we already have in place. So rather than have a duplicitous system, I'd like for the ICF credential and for our work to be considered by the Senate as you go forward.
Thank you. I might have to differ a little bit with you when you say you're not a part of the mental health. I believe in a holistic approach to physical and mental and behavioral health wellness, and you are so much a part of that. And we have had so much fragmentation with physical health and mental health and oral health, and I want a holistic approach. And I feel that you are a part of that holistic approach to wellness, and that's what I'm looking at. So,
can I make a comment?
Yes, please.
More carrot, less stick.
More carrot, less
stick.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The fear is the door opens and, you know, what happens.
But
and yes,
important.
It is holistic. I do agree with you on that. And that, but we are not prescribing medications.
No.
And we actually refer lot of clients to therapists. We know where our limitation is. That's not where we want to go. We want to include that healing that needs to take place before they get the coach.
Yeah. Okay. So. Well, thank you. And how did they get input to the system? Can they send their ideas through what? What's your...
OHA has been doing the majority of the drafting.
So, Sarah, would you come back up here? Because there are people with some ideas, and I'd like to have a venue for them to be able to... be able to get their ideas and concerns to the public process. I know they stated it here. I would like to have that your testimony be sent to who do they send it to?
They send it to me if they want.
Do they send it to Oliver Droppers?
Yeah.
Okay. Oliver Droppers is our analyst, and so your testimony needs to be sent to him. And Sarah, I want to make sure that you are able to respond to some of the concerns that have been risen today.
Sure. For the record, again, Sarah Lochner, Oregon Health Authority. I'm happy to take any productive feedback via email, and you can reach me at, I'll spell it for, or say it first and then spell it, sarah.j.lochner at state.or.us, and that is spelled S-A-R-A-H dot J as in Jackson, dot Lochner, L-O-C-H-N-E-R, at state.or.us. I have a handful of cards. I can leave them over on the table as well, but I don't know that I have enough for everybody.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2303A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2398A. Oliver.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2304, brought to you by the Oregon Law Center. The bill prohibits health care providers from billing Medicaid recipients, except as established by the Oregon Health Authority. The rulemaking requires health care providers for claims unpaid after 90 days to check with OHA to confirm an individual's eligibility for Medicaid.
John Mullen and Courtney Dresser.
There's no amendment, and we have testimony on all this.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record,
Would you please have your conversations outside? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center here to talk to you about House Bill 2398. Just a little bit of a brief background. People are aware of the Oregon Law Center and the work that we do with clients around the state, in addition to the work that we do here in the building.
Never heard of it.
Oh, okay. I'll be happy to send you a brochure. Basically, this issue arose from our attorneys around the state that they would regularly over the years would have situations where an Oregon Health Plan recipient was billed for services, for covered service, where they didn't owe anything. In addition to that, some providers had wound up sending these claims to collections, and a person would first of all get the bill, and they would be surprised to get the bill, and then the next thing they knew it was in collections, and then that made it very difficult. If you have a credit report that shows that you haven't taken care of a bill, that can make it hard to rent an apartment. It also could make it difficult for somebody to think about how they come forward next and ask for medical services if this is a concern, particularly if there are language barriers or disabling conditions. Now, I just would say that providers are not the bad guys here. There's some confusion that sometimes happens in the billing process. So my good friend and colleague, Ms. Dresser, will be testifying next. And we're all part of the Human Services Coalition, providers and advocates. But this is something where I think a simple fix is in order. And basically what the bill does is a couple of things. It basically says that for somebody that there's a billing for a service that goes either to the Oregon Health Authority if it's fee-for-service, or the coordinated care organization if it's somebody that's receiving their services through that, that there would be a period of time of 90 days that they would wait before assigning the bill to collections. But first, before they did that, would go ahead and query the MMIS system to see if the person was indeed eligible for OHP. This doesn't happen very often. When we looked at it back in February, there were about 357 cases in the queue. When you look at a million or so people, it's not a very big percent. But if you're a low-income person and you wind up getting caught up in this and you have a situation where your bill gets sent on to collections, it's a really difficult issue for that particular person. The bill also includes a discussion with a stakeholder group, which would include advocates and providers, and a report back to the legislature in September 2018. And that would give us an opportunity to see how this really rather modest kind of change is going to work and make sure that we're on course to make sure that this happens as infrequently as possible. So, Madam Chair, with that, I'll conclude my testimony and would look forward to the support of this committee for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm Courtney Dresser for the Oregon Medical Association, and we're just here to speak to kind of how the process works now. And I think if Mr. Mullins and I were king and queen for the day, we probably have a different solution to this. But right now what happens is that providers check before the date of service, on the date of service, and after the date of service to ensure eligibility, and that they use the information that is provided by OHA system to bill who is appropriate. So either it's going to the patient's OHA or OHP insurer, or it's going to the patient. The providers do not look to bill patients if they have insurance. That's just not how the system works. And so this concept does add a little bit of administrative burden on the providers, as they're now going to have to hold bills and then recheck again. So it does take some time away from other services that they're doing, and their clinics will have to do some extra work to kind of get that reimbursement that, again, they believe they were getting before they even did the service, because they would not have provided the service to the patient if they needed to bill them. They would have checked for the patient first. So we would hope that the system would be a little better in that they could check and be clear and be done, and we wouldn't have this issue. But we know that it's a problem, and we want to address it as best we can. And we're very appreciative of Mr. Mullins putting a stakeholder group in, because we do hope that we can continue this conversation.
Great. Senator Steinhaber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the reasons we have this problem is because due to a series of technical issues, there has been a problem with redetermination, and it's something that my committee co-chair, Representative Rayfield, and I have been working on with OHA very, very hard, as the OHA people will attest, since we've been pestering them unmercilessly. Anyway, we are actually going to be adding KPMs, key performance measures, to OHA this year with their agreement, to decrease the number of people on open card and minimize the lag time minimize the number of people who fall off eligibility and then are redetermined to be eligible, because largely this is an issue around redetermination of eligibility. People check, they are eligible on March 25th, they come in on March 30th, and they're still eligible, and then they bill on April 1st, and they're not eligible. And this is why this is happening. I'm amazed it's frankly only 350-something cases, because I would think it might be more. Mm-hmm. There is retroactive eligibility, which is one of the things that puts people on open card and gets these issues resolved, and usually those get resolved. They get, you know, they only stay on open card for a month or two, but still that's a disruption in their care. So we're working very closely with OHA to try to decrease the incidence rate of that and the prevalence. So hopefully that's another way we're going to address this issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Haywood. I very much appreciate that thought, and we would all like every eligibility issue to be completely correct and timely and all that, but the reason for this bill is that sometimes low-income clients get caught up in this, and it's not fair to them.
Completely
and I think
agree.
Everybody that was in this discussion is of the same mind. We don't want to ever see this happen for clients, and yeah. So we hope this remedy will...
Good bill. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Any questions? Does anyone have problems with this?
No.
Then let's schedule for a work session. Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2398A and open a work session or public hearing on House Bill 2754. Oliver.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2754, brought to you by Representative Barker. The bill requires newborn children with hearing loss to be referred to a health care provider to be tested for congenital cytomegalovirus.
Cytomegalovirus.
Megalo.
Don't worry about it.
All right. Thank you, Senator. CMV. I was going there, but all right. Requires the Oregon Health Authority to educate healthcare professionals and diagnostic testing facilities through print materials about CMV, including signs, symptoms, and treatment options. There's no amendments. Leaving the House, there was a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue, and it was passed out of the House unanimously.
Chair Monica Anderson and Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Amy Nelson Horton, and I am here to testify in support of House Bill 2754. In November 2002, my son Nolan was born severely disabled due to congenital cytomegalovirus, or CMV. Nolan was silent when he was born. The nurses had to rub his chest to initiate his first breath. When the nurses handed him to me for the first time, he looked yellow and was covered in little red dots. The nurses assured me that he had a rough ride during delivery and that it was common for newborns to have little red dots, also known as petechiae. A few hours after Nolan's arrival, another nurse came into the room and informed me that Nolan had failed his newborn hearing screening. Nolan's hearing was tested multiple times before we were discharged, and the results were all the same. The next 2 weeks were a blur. Nolan was born in Silverton, but we ended up at the Salem Hospital because he wasn't eating. Our trip to the Salem Hospital to visit the lactation nurse started a chain of events that ended up saving Nolan's life. We were lost and on the wrong floor when a nurse from Legacy Emmanuel approached us, asking if we needed help. She gazed down at Nolan and his carrier and immediately started asking questions. She said Nolan's skin was mottled and she was concerned with his breathing. She rushed us into the special care nursery and started working on him and calling for assistance. After a few short days with no diagnosis, a pediatrician ordered a culture of Nolan's urine where CMV was detected. After the culture came back positive for CMV, the doctor ordered a CT scan of Nolan's brain. The CT scan showed that Nolan had brain damage. Nolan was stabilized, and we were sent home 1 week later. We were home for less than 24 hours when I noticed Nolan was struggling to breathe. We went back to the Salem Hospital, where we were later transported to Dornbecker Children's Hospital. While at Dornbecker, I was told that CMV was rare and that Nolan did not have the brain capacity to sustain life. The infectious disease specialist then advised me to consider placing a do not resuscitate order on Nolan and gave us the devastating news that it would be hopeful if Nolan made it to his first Christmas. Nolan was sent home and placed on hospice care. For weeks, I watched him struggle to survive. Weeks turned into months, and months turned into years, and thankfully, Nolan saw his first Christmas and many more. He is now 14.
I have been told that I contracted CMV early in my pregnancy due to the enormous impact that Nolan's brain suffered from this horrible virus. Nolan has pockets of fluid and calcifications where there should be normal brain matter. Nolan can't sit or stand on his own. He is fed through a G-tube. He has seizure disorder. He is deaf. He is blind. He wears braces on his feet. He is nonverbal. And he is referred to as a spastic quadriplegic that requires total care. It has been a rewarding yet intense 14 years. A mother should not have to welcome her baby into the world with a death sentence. Our journey has led me here today because as my knowledge about CMV expands, I can no longer keep quiet. CMV is a public health issue, and education, along with targeted screening, is necessary. CMV is not rare. According to the CDC, congenital CMV is the most common viral cause of birth defects and developmental disabilities in the United States. Each year, 30,000 children are born with congenital CMV, causing 400 deaths and leaving 8,000 children with permanent disabilities. More children will have disabilities due to congenital CMV than other well-known infections and syndromes, including Down syndrome, fetal alcohol syndrome, spina bifida, and pediatric HIV/AIDS. Congenital CMV is the leading non-genetic cause of childhood hearing loss. House Bill 2754 requires a newborn with hearing loss to be referred to a healthcare provider for the purpose of diagnosing whether the newborn child has congenital CMV infection. It also states that the referral shall take place within 21 days of the newborn child's date of birth. There is hope for newborns that are diagnosed early, within 21 days of life. According to the 2015 Red Book, which is the official report of the Committee on Infectious Diseases of the American Academy of Pediatrics, they make the following important statement about the current standard of care of congenital CMV infection. Neonates with symptomatic congenital CMV disease with or without central nervous system involvement have improved audiologic and neurodevelopment outcomes at 2 years of age when treated with oral valganciclovir, and then it gives the dose that they're given orally twice daily for 6 months. Anyone can become infected with CMV. Most people don't realize that they have been infected with CMV. CMV is very common in home and daycare settings. Healthy children 1 to 3 years of age are at high risk for contracting CMV from their peers. CMV is found in bodily fluids, including urine, saliva, blood, mucus, and tears. Mothers and women who work with infants and young children should be educated about the risks of CMV and the precautions they can take to prevent infection. One of the highest risk groups is pregnant women who have not yet contracted CMV prior to pregnancy, as they will possibly, pass the virus to their unborn child, causing potential birth defects. The lack of information about CMV has impacted me personally. If I would have known about CMV before or during my pregnancy, I would have altered my behavior to prevent transmission to my unborn child. By not sharing food and drinks with toddlers, hand washing, and avoiding contact with saliva when kissing a child. Thank you. These behavioral hygiene precautions are supported by the American Academy of Pediatrics and also by a recent international consensus statement of CMV experts from around the world, published by the Lancet of Infectious Diseases by Rawlinson. Unfortunately, these seem like simple hygiene tasks, but I, along with many other pregnant women, did not follow these guidelines because of the lack of information and education regarding the transmission of CMV and the potential complications associated with congenital CMV. House Bill 2754 directs the Oregon Health Authority to compile and disseminate information on congenital CMV. Awareness and education about how CMV is transmitted will help guide pregnant women to take the steps to prevent the transmission to their unborn child during pregnancy. Lastly, this bill provides two key functions, targeted screening and education. Together with your support, we can change the course of another baby's life by reducing the risk of congenital CMV.
Thank you very much. And thank you for sharing your story. Very, very powerful.
Yeah. Madam Chair, if I could say, you know, things like Zika, I had the opportunity to meet with you, and thank you for coming to meet with me ahead of this committee. And what I said then, and I'll say now, is CMV is infinitely more common than Zika. And we're making all this fuss about Zika, but CMV has been around forever. And we don't do a good job of educating women before pregnancy or testing them. We don't have enough data yet to suggest that testing everybody routinely for CMV with routine prenatal labs makes sense. Mm-hmm. But having more conversations, it's impossible to avoid completely. I mean, we all go to the grocery store and touch stuff and whatever. But some basic precautions, just as we do for toxoplasmosis for families with cats, is not that hard to do. And it's simply a matter of education. And frankly, I think we should be moving this upstream and encouraging maternity care providers to educate women at their first prenatal visit, because we could prevent a lot of these problems.
So that's one thing in the bill. You know, the Oregon Health Authority is supposed to disseminate this information to hospitals, birthing centers, diagnostic facilities that conduct newborn hearing, but it doesn't say anything about disseminating information to the prenatal providers. Okay. All right. Well, I see the Oregon Health Authority is not here. I was wanting to know what the fiscal was. I mean, they are supposed to do all of this, and it's probably a minimal, but yeah, they get lots of minimals of. Okay, and then the hospitals. The hospitals have no problem with this because you're already doing it. The hospitals.
They're already. Chair Monis Anderson. They're already conducting the newborn hearing screening, and so it's just a referral when the child fails their newborn hearing screening.
And that could be as simple, Madam Chair, as giving the family an information sheet that they would take to the child's family physician or pediatrician at the first, you know, the 3-day wait check or whatever, because they give them information that the child has hearing loss, and that gets transmitted to the child's primary care provider as well, because we have to know about that to do further testing as well. It's just a question of figuring out what the cause of the hearing loss is and not just assuming it's some isolated neurologic event.
Schedule it.
Okay, yeah, I think we can schedule it. So let's do that, Oliver, and I'll close. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2754. And colleagues, for House Bill 30, I'll briefly open a public hearing on House Bill 3014A. And this was at the request of the Oregon Society for Respiratory Care, and they are not here. So I would like to just move that bill to the following day, Thursday. Or do we have time Thursday?
You carry it over.
Yeah. Let's carry over this bill to Thursday.
You have that power.
You do have that power.
And then I don't know who the Oregon. You'll figure that out. All right, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3014, and we're adjourned. And we're adjourned.